to VOA1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Gina Bennett has a story on how U.S. cities are using mental health teams to answer some emergency 911 calls. Faith Perlow has this week's Ask a Teacher about the difference between the words cheer and applause. Faith and I then explain the meaning of the phrase live for. Later, we listen to part one of Jack London's Love of Life. But first,
Clear Creek County in Colorado is one of the latest places to begin using mental health teams to answer some emergency 911 calls. Mental health response teams are not new. Many large cities put such teams in place after the killing of George Floyd during his arrest by police in Minneapolis in 2020. Some people believe mental health response teams might be more successful in answering some emergency 911 calls than police. The job of a mental health worker is to help people who have emotional problems or mental sickness. The job of the police is to enforce laws. They are not trained to treat mental health conditions. In Clear Creek County, the case of Christian Glass received a lot of attention. News reports said Glass called the 911 emergency phone number when his car got stuck on the roadside. Police answered the call, but Glass refused to get out of his car. Later, the police broke the car window. Glass threatened them with a small knife. He was then shot and killed by police. The lawyer for Glass's parents said he was having a mental health crisis. He believed that supernatural beings meant to harm him. After legal action, Clear Creek County agreed to pay $19 million as a result of the case, and two officers face criminal charges. New York City officials said mental health response teams resolve half of their calls by talking to people or taking them to social services or community health centers. However, the Associated Press, AP, reported that workers for the city's mental health crisis program, called Be Heard, have had difficulty dealing with the number of calls and cases. The program answered about 2% of the 171,000 calls throughout the city in 2022. Carly Cylon was a mental health response team supervisor who used to work in a program in Denver, Colorado. She said mental health teams aim to meet the needs of the community and send the right experts to solve the problems. Mental health teams may also have more time to spend in response to an emergency call than police. That could be a reason that mental health response teams might be more successful than police in answering some 911 calls. For example, a mental health team responded to a 911 call about a homeless man in Denver, Colorado. The team spent 3 hours helping the man get a form of identification, food, and medications. They also took him to a shelter designed to house homeless people. Police might spend 10 to 90 minutes on a call. This would not be long enough to help a homeless person. At least 14 of America's 20 biggest cities are using mental health teams to answer some emergency 911 calls. New York City, Los Angeles, Houston, Texas, and Columbus, Ohio spent almost $125 million on their programs. Smaller cities are also starting to use the teams. The AP reports that federal government information is incomplete on how effective mental health response teams are. But a recent study of a mental health response program in Denver from Stanford University suggested they have good results. The 2022 study found that in some Denver neighborhoods where the programs were in place, few small crimes were reported while violent crimes remained unchanged. At a conference discussing mental health teams in Washington, D.C. this spring, officials from several cities discussed using mental health response teams. They said they faced difficulties in finding enough trained mental health workers, training workers at 911 call centers, and sending unarmed civilians into situations that could be dangerous. However, an official for New York's Be Heard program believes the effort is important. LaQuisha Grant is with the New York Mayor's Office of Community Mental Health. She said, "We really think that every single Be Heard response is just a better way that we, the city, are providing care to people." I'm Dr. Gina Bennett.
There. This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question about the difference between cheers and applause. Hello, VOA Learning English. I am Sina from Iran. I have been learning English with your app for 2 years. I have a question. What is the difference between cheers and applause? Thank you. Thanks for writing to us, Sina. These two words can mean to express approval or excitement. But the way that these feelings are expressed is a little different. Cheering uses your voice, and applauding uses your hands to clap and make a sound. But let's look a little closer at each.
I live for the applause, applause, applause. I live for the applause, applause, live for the
Applause is a noun that has two meanings. The first meaning is the approval or excitement, marked by clapping hands together. The second meaning is the show of approval through praise or vocalizing. Lady Gaga sang that she lives for the applause of her fans. Applaud is the verb form and also has two meanings. When you applaud something, you are showing your approval or excitement by clapping your hands together. The verb can either take a direct object or not. The crowd applauded the dancers during the show. The audience applauded after the musical performance. The second meaning of applaud is to praise or say that you like or agree with something that a person has done. My professor applauded my work this year. Let's move on to cheer. Much like applaud, cheer, as a verb, means to show approval or excitement by vocalizing or shouting. Parents cheered on their children at the soccer game. To cheer also means to perform the act of cheerleading. Cheerleaders are people who lead the crowds at sporting events through cheering and applauding the teams. They encourage their team to win. Kirsten cheered in school for the basketball team. As a verb, cheer also means to be cheerful or to make glad or happy. We often use this verb with the preposition up. In the command, cheer up. You look so unhappy. Cheer up. He cheered his girlfriend up with flowers. Cheer is also a noun, and its meanings are closely related to the verb form. Cheer is a shout of approval or excitement. The cheers of the crowd grew louder as the football team started winning. Cheer is the sport or activity of cheerleading. There are different kinds of shoes needed in cheer, depending on what position you are in. Cheer also has other meanings as a noun, such as a mood or feeling, gladness or joy, or encouragement. Holidays are a time for good cheer and making memories with family. And we often say cheers before eating or drinking at a party or social gathering. Cheers to the happy couple on their wedding day. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you, Sina. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
That was this week's Ask a Teacher. Welcome back to the show, Faith.
Thanks for having me back, Dan.
This week, you answered a question about cheer and applause. And we just listened to a sample of Lady Gaga's song, Applause. Can you explain to our listeners what live for means?
Sure. In the song, Lady Gaga says that she lives for the applause of her fans. Live for is a phrasal verb that has a couple different meanings and uses. It can mean that you think of something as the most important or enjoyable thing in your life, and you dedicate your life to that thing. It can mean the reason for you being alive and giving your life meaning and purpose. And lastly, it can be used to express that you are hoping or waiting for something to happen, and you are very eager and excited for it to happen. Since Lady Gaga is very dedicated to her fans, and she loves them, she lives for their applause, their approval, and their happiness.
So, what do you live for, Faith?
I feel like I live for a lot of things. When I was teaching, I lived for my students and their questions and their learning. I live for my cat, my guinea pigs, and my husband. They are all super important in my life. I also live for singing and dancing and taking walks. Those are all my favorite activities. And I live for the day when my student loans are paid off. What do you live for, Dan?
Since we're near the end of summer, I live for days reading on the beach, I live for evenings eating crabs, and I live for watching and playing baseball.
Those all sound like very important things in your life, Dan. And since everyone is unique, we all live for different things. Maybe our listeners can now think about what they live for. What is important or creates happiness or excitement for their lives?
Thanks for joining me, Faith.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 1.
The two men moved painfully down the bank and fell among the rocks that were scattered everywhere. They were tired and weak. Their faces showed the patient appearance that results from difficulty long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs which were tied to their shoulders. Each man carried a gun. They walked in a leaning position, the shoulders forward, the head farther forward, the eyes fixed upon the ground.
"I wish we had a couple of those cartridges that are lying in our cache," said the second man. His voice was completely without expression. And the first man, walking into the milky stream that flowed over the rocks, made no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their shoes, although the water was icy cold. It was so cold that their feet soon were without feeling. In places the water dashed against their knees, and both men found it difficult to remain standing. The man who followed slipped upon a smooth rock and nearly fell. He recovered his footing with great effort, at the same time uttering a sharp cry of pain. He seemed faint and stretched one hand forward, seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward, but he slipped again and nearly fell. Then he stood still and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as if he were deciding something. Then he called out,
I say, Bill, I hurt my foot.
Bill struggled ahead through the milky water. He did not look around. The man watched him go, and although his face lacked expression as before, his eyes had the look of a wounded animal. The other man climbed the farther bank of the stream and continued straight ahead, without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His lips trembled a little.
"Bill!" he cried.
It was the despairing cry of a strong man in trouble. But Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, struggling forward up the hill toward the skyline. He watched him go until he passed over the hilltop and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly examined the circle of the world that remained to him, now that Bill was gone. The sun was low in the sky, almost hidden by a cover of clouds. The man looked at his watch while supporting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The season was near the end of July or the first of August. He did not know the exact date within a week or two, but that was enough to know that the sun marked the northwest. He looked to the south and decided that somewhere beyond those hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that behind the same hills, the Arctic Circle cut its way across the plains of northern Canada, called the Barrens. This stream in which he stood flowed into the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a map. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a cheerful sight. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no grasses. There was nothing but a vast emptiness that brought fear into his eyes. "Bill!" he whispered once and twice. "Bill!" He stood trembling in the milky water, feeling the vastness pressing in upon him with great force. He began to shake as with a disease, until the gun falling from his hand into the stream brought him back to reality. He fought with his fear and regained his self-control. He recovered the gun from the water. He pushed his pack more toward his left shoulder. This helped to take a portion of its weight off the foot he had hurt. Then he proceeded slowly and carefully, in great pain, to the bank of the stream. He did not stop, with a worry that was madness, unmindful of the pain. He hurried up the hill to the top over which his companion had disappeared. But at the top he saw a valley empty of life. He fought with his fear again and won. Then once more he moved the pack farther toward his left shoulder and struggled down the hill. The bottom of the valley was very wet. Thick plant life held the moisture close to the surface, and the water flowed from under his feet at every step. He picked his way carefully across the valley and followed the other man's footsteps along the rocks, which made small islands in the sea of wet plant life. Although alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew, he would come to where dead pine trees bordered the shore of a little lake. In the language of that country, it was called the Land of Little Sticks. Into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was grass along that stream, but no trees. He would follow the stream until it divided. He would cross this place of dividing to another stream flowing to the west. This he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. Here he would find a cache under an upturned boat covered with many rocks. In this cache there would be cartridges for his empty gun, and fish hooks and lines. Everything he needed for catching food would be there. Also, he would find flour, a little meat, and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would find a boat and row south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, until they came to the Mackenzie River. And south, always south they would go, while the winter raced after them, and the ice formed in the streams, and the days grew cold. South they would go,
to some warm place where the trees grew tall and full, and there was food without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he struggled forward. But as strongly as he struggled with his body, he struggled equally with his mind. He tried to believe that Bill had not deserted him. Surely Bill would wait for him at the cache. He was forced to think this thought, otherwise there would not be any reason to continue, and he would lie down and die. As the ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, he recalled every inch of his and Bill's flight south ahead of the oncoming winter, and he thought again and again of the food in the cache. It had been 2 days since he had anything to eat. It was a far longer time since he had had enough to eat. Often he picked muskeg berries, put them into his mouth, and ate them. A muskeg berry is a small seed in a drop of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed tastes bitter. The man knew there was no real food value in the berries, but he ate them, patiently, with a hope greater than his experience. At 9 o'clock that night, he hit his toe on a rocky surface, and from weakness and tiredness, he fell to the ground. He lay for some time without movement on his side. He took his pack from his back and dragged himself into a sitting position. It was not yet dark. While some light remained, he felt among the rocks for pieces of dried plants. When he had gathered a pile, he built a fire and put a tin pot of water on it to boil. He unwrapped his pack. The first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to be sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in paper. He put one portion in his empty tobacco pack, another in the inside band of his hat, and a third under his shirt against his flesh. This accomplished, he began to worry whether he had counted correctly. He unwrapped them all and counted them again. Yes, there were 67. He dried his wet shoes and socks by the fire. The moccasins were badly torn. His socks were worn through in places and his feet were bleeding. The area between his foot and leg, the ankle, was very painful. He examined it. It had swelled until it was as large as his knee. He cut a long strip from one of his 2 blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He cut other strips and bound them about his feet to serve both for moccasins and socks. Then he drank the pot of hot water, wound his watch, and pulled his blankets around him. He slept like a dead man. The brief darkness at midnight came and went. Then the sun rose in the northeast. It can be better said that day dawned in that quarter of the sky because the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock in the morning, he waked, quietly, lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he lifted himself on his elbow, he was frightened by a loud noise. There was a caribou looking at him curiously. The animal was not more than 50 feet away, and instantly into the man's mind came the picture of caribou meat cooking over a fire. From habit, he reached for the empty gun and aimed it. The caribou leaped away and disappeared across the rocks.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.